Welcome to this episode of George of the Rings, your only podcast for detailed breakdowns of the George Lopez Show, episode by episode. I'm one of your hosts, Kyle, normally joined by my co-host, Tim, and usually we don't have time to talk about the George Lopez Show. Usually we have an interview scheduled and we cut short, but I made the time this time, but he's actually not here today, so we won't be able to talk about the episode where after George forgets his and Angie's wedding anniversary, he goes to drastic measures to make up for her when she gets revenge on him with a dirt cake. So actually I have a really exciting episode. I'm very excited to talk to creator Chad Sell about one of my favorite, I guess, all ages, young adults, graphic novel series, Cardboard Kingdom. So this is something that comes up frequently because I work one day a week at Barnes & Noble because you get a 40% discount on books, and it's great. And all my kids do is read. So, like, and kids' books are ridiculously expensive. But this is, I guess, shelved in the kids' graphic novels.
Sure, yeah.
But, I mean, that's what's so interesting about kind of the kids, young adult graphic novel setting for me is that, like, while it is, like, you guys cover, like, such a wide range of topics that, like, obviously I feel like it could be something that, like, a 15-year-old could pick up. But, again, also, like, I read it on my own and enjoy it, but I also read it with my kids and enjoy it. Like, how does it sit for you that kind of like where the book may be put or kind of like the appeal of the book in general?
I mean, I think that you and your family is like the ideal reading audience, you know? I mean, what's funny is that, you know, I wrote Cardboard Kingdom with 10 other writers, which I'm happy to discuss how all that worked, but none of us have kids. Like none of us really are experts in what kids want to read. So we were just writing the stories we wanted to tell, you know? We really weren't trying to dumb anything down or simplify things too much. Like there are some heavy, thoughtful, emotional, complicated stories in there. And, you know, I am thrilled when I hear adults who have read it and enjoyed it. That's awesome, you know? I think hopefully we're kind of challenging kids and broadening their perspectives and their thoughts on what a story can be and what people can be. You know, it's fascinating to me to hear about different kids, which characters they like the most, what they get out of it, what ages the different kids are, and when adults like it. Like it's been fascinating and awesome to get all kinds of different reactions in the few years since the first book of Cardboard Kingdom came.
And I think it's interesting too is, and we've covered a lot of, I think, more of the younger adult stuff over this past year because again, it's of interest to me, not only with kids, but again, I think it is where a majority of comics is going, especially with the market. Like it's such a, at least for publishers, like it's a very popular selling market. But also I think it is kind of where you're seeing comics explore more creatively, not only with storytelling, but I think artistically, I think there's more experimenting happening with the young adult market. And again, I think especially with storytelling, like you said, the stuff that works, and I think the stuff you're seeing a lot more of, I mean, you know, Guts and Sisters and Smile, like my youngest is reading right now, like those are stories that aren't necessarily like dumbing things down for kids, because I think kids specifically, I remember being a kid, like that, you pick up on that stuff very quickly. Like this is, you want something that is told to you, not at you. And I think, you know, stuff like Cardboard Kingdom or like anything we're seeing that's really popular right now is our, I think, stories that are working on all levels specifically. Like I think the second you kind of try to think what a kid wants versus just telling a good story, I think kids pick up on that very quickly.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You know, I hear about young readers who read the book over and over, and I kind of think that they're trying, that they're working to understand it better and more deeply, you know? Because I think I've seen kids sit down in front of me and like, you know, read quote unquote the book in like 20 minutes. And you're just sort of like, oh, yes. Wow, that's like 2 years of my life. And they just like flipped through it. And, but then their parents tell me, oh, and then they kept reading it over and over again. And I think it's so fascinating to actually watch that in front of you. And I think that kids read comics in such different ways, you know, some, I think, pore over every panel, whereas others, I think, kind of want to see everything that's in the book first and then go back and enjoy it. You know, I think there's, I know friends who, you know, skipped the last page of a book and read the last page just so they know where it all goes. You know, I think that's a kind of a, almost a way of dealing with anxiety or certainty. Like, this book isn't going to surprise me in a way I don't like. I want to know where this is heading. So I don't know. I'm just really interested in the many different ways that we relate to storytelling and how we process like what's actually on a page of a graphic novel.
Well, yeah, and I think, I mean, I hate relating it to it, but you know, 7-year-old and 6-year-old, and the 7-year-old can read. So he, you know, same type of thing. Like, I give him a book. I just gave him Baba Yaga's Assistant today. Like, it's, you know, it's pretty thick. He read it in like 10 minutes. He's like, Dad, I'm done. I'm like, you did it. You did it. Yeah. But the same thing, he reads it, then he'll go back to it and read it. And then the 6-year-old, who just turned 6, he can't read yet, but he reads this series specifically. Like, he'll read it every other night, and he just sits and, like, you know, because it's a visual medium, he can kind of get the stories, and I often will read it to him, but he just makes up his own dialogue, and he's able to kind of figure out the larger, broader scope of it. So he tells his own stories within it, and then again, as he gets older, he's like understanding things more. So again, I think comics specifically is such a great medium kind of for everyone to kind of, like you said, get, it's so layered, you can get more out of it the more you read, or you can kind of get the bare minimum of what you need out of it. And yeah. I think specifically Roar of the Beast just come out. Again, it's fantastic. And I was really interested to see how you guys tackled the storytelling and the plotting in this one, because the first one was really great, and I loved that it was broken up in almost kind of issues, and then you had a like a larger plot over it, but everyone kind of got their own really like introduction and really character arc. And in Roar of the Beast, you guys kind of tackle a more like long form arc throughout, and then those like arcs happen within the course of that story. Was that something early on going into the second one you wanted to focus more kind of on a larger story versus kind of, I mean, you already got the introductions out of the way?
Yeah. I think in book one, they're kind of like the different chapters each focus on a different kid, and all the kids live in the same neighborhood, for those who haven't read. And they're essentially origin stories. You know, one reviewer described Cardboard Kingdom as sort of like this kid version of Avengers, where you get to know each kid and then you see them all team up into fun groupings, good guys and bad guys and the shopkeepers and the scientists. And so once we introduced all those characters in book one, we were all in love with these characters. They were living in this big, vibrant, fun world. Book one takes place in the summertime and it ends when school starts. And then, you know, for a sequel, what just came to me as like an ideal kind of organic, intuitive way of continuing the series is to have it set in the week leading up to Halloween. So it's a few months after the end of book one. And we see the kids as they're getting ready for Halloween, whatever that might entail, whether that means making scarier versions of their alter ego costumes or something like that, or making plans for Halloween night. And I was really excited to try telling one big story with this huge cast of characters in the Cardboard Kingdom neighborhood. I had a blast at the end of book one. Once you meet all the kids, they have an epic adventure at the end of the summer before school starts. And that was so much fun to write. And it's very epic. The kids they fight giant versions of some of the kids who've banded together as the villains, the army of evil. And so I kind of wanted to take that same approach, but with the whole book. And it was exceedingly complicated. I had never really written a mystery before. And there's like a big mystery at the heart of book two of Cardboard Kingdom, Roar of the Beast. But, you know, it was really exciting. It was really fun. I find myself incorporating scarier and spookier stuff in my books the more I do them. You know, Doodleville, my other graphic novel, gets kind of intense and psychological. So it's just this like interesting trend. But yeah, that's the overview of what we wanted to do in book two. I don't mean to
talk about it. How did in the first one, like, I mean, it makes sense with kind of the 10 writers and you have those kind of segments with them. How did that translate then to this one where everyone kind of got, it seemed like everyone kind of had their input as to like the people they created, I think in the summary in the back of the book. How did that translate writing a larger story with 10 other voices with you kind of corralling that all into one larger narrative?
Yeah, I mean, book one, like you said, is pretty self-explanatory because the different contributors each contributed one or two characters to the book and wrote that chapter, that corresponding chapter. In book two, I shared my basic broad premise of like a Halloween story featuring these kids with the team. And I had a bunch of phone calls with them at the start, just individually, like, based on this, what do you think your character would be doing? What would they be interested in? Who would they be teaming up with or fighting against in the neighborhood? So in book two, you see some like very organic groupings of kids, like the Army of Evil. You see several of the scientifically and scholarly minded kids joining together as the Science Squad. There is a team of superheroic guardians of the Cardboard Kingdom called the Cardboard Crusaders. So we found these natural kind of groupings within this big community of kids. And that automatically kind of brought together two or three authors with each of those groups. And we discussed what each character would be up to. We figured out the big beats of the big mystery of this mysterious monster that starts showing up at night. And the way that different kids react to an unknown, scary thing, how they interpret it, how they develop different plans of attacking it or capturing it or understanding it or exploiting it. And then in terms of actually writing the book, I came up based on everyone's input with like a broad outline, and then we sort of parceled out scenes and, you know, have like documents on Google Docs and stuff so that we can all keep track of what everyone's doing. But it was a very elaborate juggling act. It was very intense to, you know, with a big cast and with a mystery, just figuring out who knows what, when, what is being revealed at what point, it's logistically very tricky. So I think that we did a good job. I think that it reads suspensefully, and I hope most of the plot points are really clear and exciting. And we were always trying to keep the emotional core of the book as like the guiding principle. No matter what twist and turn and surprise and reveal there might be, we always wanted it to deepen the emotional relationships between the kids in the book, you know. And so we really put them through a lot because there's an issue of secrets and who can tell who what they want to tell and who there's like loyalty tested. And it's a really intense emotional book. I think I'm all about big feelings, you know. For whatever reason, all my books have really big, earnest exploration of like the emotional extremes like that I go through and that I think kids.
Yeah, and I think too, not only kind of juggling all of the plot lines that are going on in that first book, again, kind of everyone gets their little bit of time to shine. So I was interested to see in this one again that kind of brought everyone more together throughout it. Like, was everyone going to get their little bit? Because I think like everyone kind of had their favorite characters going in. Like, I was like, if there's not a lot of robot, we're going to have issues. And I think you handled that well. And also like getting those kind of general reactions of how someone that age might react works to kind of have that, I think, over-exaggerated type thing. Because everything to, I think, younger people is, you know, it's the end of the world. It is like, you know, if something like that happens, so it's easy to kind of get invested. And I also think like having a book kind of based in those multiple emotions, like you said, for kids, I think whether or not they understand it or feel it, like it gives them the avenue to at least witness it and empathize with it. So like later on when they may experience it either themselves or see someone else experience it, they may be able to emphasize it. We cover a lot of, like, I love horror, and I specifically, I think horror works very well where it is a genre that you can tackle social issues, because you can then, you know, you can have a monster scare someone and you can feel scared, but you can relate to that because of that feeling. And if you kind of tie that through, you know, whether it's something like Us or there's a lot of, you know, books or comics that tackle, like, you know, the horror of being a woman in a man's world, like, those things work because you can relate them to emotions. And I think something like Cardboard Kingdom, like, for kids or, you know, anyone, again, you tackle topics of either, like, divorce or, you know, abusive father, or, you know, again, you know, Jack, who feels comfortable being, you know, the sorceress versus, you know, the prince or whatever, like, those are big ideas, and to kind of push them through emotionally, I think is a really great thing you do in this for kids specifically.
Thank you. Yeah, I mean, one of the big things that I talk about when I visit schools and stuff or do virtual visits is talking about how it's important to me that there's a huge neighborhood of kids in Cardboard Kingdom, and you get to know all of them and understand what they're all dealing with. Even the kid that others see as a bully, he eventually gets his own chapter in book one, and we understand why he's doing what he does. And crucially, I tell kids that it's important that you understand that everyone has their own story. You know, you don't necessarily know what everyone has gone through. So that was a really important thing that I wanted to convey, like you said, showing a wide variety of different kids dealing with a lot of different things, different identities, different family situations, and getting that sense of compassion, understanding, and inclusivity was a really important thing for me. And one of the really fun things in book two is that it allows us to focus on some different characters, you know, to let, you know, there are certain characters like Sam the Goblin, the Jack the Sorceress's little sister, who wasn't a huge character in book one, but she has, like, some of my favorite moments in book two. And I love to hear that you are a fan of the robot, because she's one of my absolute favorites. I think characters with an extreme worldview and way of processing and expressing themselves in the world are really fun to write, you know, and I think are often fun to read. And the robot is absolutely one of the more distinctive characters in the book, because she acts like a robot as sort of like a defense mechanism to deal with her own awkwardness and inability to understand other people's emotional states. And so she typically speaks like, you know, the robot invasion is imminent, you know. And, you know, even though there are some characters who don't have huge roles in the overarching mystery, like the robot, I'm super proud that she gets, like, some really good scenes in book two, you know? So it's just really, I'm a huge comics fan. I love, you know, classic Claremont X-Men, a huge ensemble, and seeing characters with arcs over decades and surprising character combinations and moments and revelations. I think that that's all so exciting. And that's, like, what we're trying to capture at our best in Cardboard Kingdom, this big, rich world that feels lived in and complicated surprising.
And I think you guys hit it out of the park in every instance of that. And I think, so we're talking about kind of you know, obviously kind of corralling all these characters and kids and really, I think even more so, like we said, a really big, when I say characters, like the people are actual characters. Again, you're writing a robot who would be one thing if you're writing a robot, but you're writing a girl who is playing a robot. So, like, there's the multiple layers of how you're writing her. But in addition, you're drawing all this, which is, like, insane. Talking about kind of comics and your style, like, anyone may be familiar, like, you do these really beautiful drawings for, like, RuPaul's Drag Race. And, like, your ability to kind of stylize things is amazing. How did this all kind of, like with Doodleville or something like this, is that something in instance of, like, your style adapting to this or finding that your style worked in this kind of realm? Is there, like how did the kind of, like, young adult comics and, like, your style come about? Was that something you had set out to do, or just, like, your style works within that and those are kind of, like, adjacent stories you wanted to tell?
I really try to find the right style for the right project. You know, you mentioned my drag queen illustrations. I stopped doing that a few years ago, but that is what I did for quite a while and what I was best known for a long time, and may still be what I'm best known for. But, you know, that resulted in a stylistic experiment where I just started drawing with like very simple color shapes and drew some of my favorite drag queen looks from RuPaul's Drag Race. And that was so fun, and it felt so new, and it felt like a perfect kind of style to capture the vibrant, fun exuberance of the best runway looks from each episode of the show. Whereas before that, I had been doing like stark line art adult comics, you know, and with like sometimes grayscale or gray tones. And I love really quality children's entertainment, like Pixar films and stuff like that. I love that children's entertainment can tell rich, complicated stories. And so I, for a long time, was interested in that. And even more than 10 years ago, I was working on early versions of Cardboard Kingdom and Doodleville, but I didn't have the skill set to sell it. You know, I tried pitching my book Doodleville more than 10 years ago to publishers. And one publisher said, "Your style isn't good for kids' books," which was totally fair because I didn't know what I was doing at that point. And it was like in black and white, and it just looked kind of stilted and not really lively. And so a big part of what I started doing in trying to appeal to a kid's book style better was really simplifying, really taking out any detail that wasn't necessary. I'm not good at realism. And when I try to add too much detail to a page, I feel like it just looks like a cluttered mess. There's a lot of stuff that I'm not good at drawing. And so over the last, you know, several years, I started figuring out what do I like drawing? What's most effective about my drawing? When I do a drawing and look at it a few weeks later, what don't I hate? What stands up to my own inner critic? And it's sort of a process of honing that, you know? And something that I learned with my illustration work, particularly of drag queens, was just how incredibly effective color is. Like, you can do so much with a big, bright, bold color. And so I color all my work at this point. And I knew that if you are going to include big, bright, bold, solid color in your work, you can get away with quite simple line art, you know? And if you're doing some like simple shading, I do the line art knowing that I'm going to add a lot of weight and volume in the shading and in the color. And I set it all up to be as streamlined and efficient in terms of my time usage as possible.
And I think often too, we have, I think maybe the general population in comics has kind of the misconception of, you know, maybe seeing something like this again, where your focus is to break things down into the most necessary shapes, colors, and lines, and what works to tell that visually. Like, that is incredibly difficult to do. I think it's easier. It's not easier to do, I think, realism in a sense to, like, you know, break the uncanny valley. But like, if you set someone out to do this, like, I think they're almost always are kind of adding more and more and more, knowing like colors and gradients and when to use lighting and back off is incredibly difficult because like you're trying to tell, but it's, I think, one of the most effective things. I mean, you look at like Mike Mignola, like that's his style, and so many people try to do it now, and it's really tough to do. And I don't think people realize how difficult it is to do. So to see like kind of your evolution in Cardboard Kingdom, especially like through that first volume and then kind of into this, like your ability to kind of just like visually narrate this series with kind of these very simplistic, like, I hate that term in the sense because it's simple because it's you know, it's the least necessary, but nothing about it is simple. Like, there's so much time and effort that goes into it, but like this page with like progression, like, it's very limited in its shapes, but like you get everything you need to get from this. And like, I think that's like really tough and amazing when people are able to do that. And I think it's underappreciated in kind of that sense.
Thanks. It's a very humbling thing in drawing a graphic novel that you'll draw over the course of a year or two, because literally the pages you start out with will look so different by the end of the book. You know, the character, you learn to draw a character by drawing them over the course of 250 pages. And so even though I was drawing the first book of Cardboard Kingdom in my early 30s, and I was like a pretty established artist and had a pretty established set of skills, the characters look really different at the start than they do by the end of the book. You know, that's a really hard thing about working on any long-term graphic novel project, that your skills change so much. It's really, really, really hard not to just go back and try to like fix everything. I did that in a lot of my early comics projects and learned just what I learned about the diminishing returns that result from that keeping the forward momentum, looking at what works and trying not to stress over what doesn't is so important.
Right.
You know, and so often the stuff that you obsess over as an artist, no one else even knows. And that's, I've accumulated a lot of these lessons. they were hard won over the course of.
Yeah, there's such a fine line, I think, where I think early on learning that it's okay to, something big we've talked about recently a lot and it's come up, is like learning it's okay to erase, or learning it's okay to start over. But then at the same time, then the next step later on is to learn when to move on and not just keep doing that. And that kind of fine line of, I mean, what makes people great is that they're often their own worst critic, but at the same time, like, again, you could spend lifetimes on a page and never quite be up to the standards you want. For one, you saw a lot of kind of experimenting in the kind of like issues and chapters, kind of based on like what fit that narrative and that tone. Famously, but the first one, the kind of the prototype, where it was the silent, visually driven one, was great. And in this one, was that more kind of the like you settling into the style of Cardboard Kingdom? And it's pretty, I think, consistent throughout in the way you approach paneling and stuff like that. Were you pretty consistent and felt comfortable with this volume, I think, visually attacking it?
For the most part, yeah. I mean, this, you know, artists can fuss or stress out over the most arbitrary of things. And one funny thing about book two, Roar of the Beast, is that a lot of scenes take place at night, and I hadn't really drawn many nighttime scenes. And so just figuring out the color palettes and shading techniques necessary for nighttime was just kind of like a learning curve. But I ended up loving a lot of the nighttime scenes, because I, you know, would draw these like beautiful starry skies with ominous clouds, you know, covering the stars. And, you know, you're right that I did experiment a lot in book one of Cardboard Kingdom, especially, you know, there were these little interludes, little double page spreads and stuff in between some chapters where I took a more painterly approach. I kind of hate those now. I regret that style. You know, there are things you can do as an artist that seem ambitious and like, wow, I'm really going to kill it with this. And you sink 10 times as much time into that page as you would a normal page. And then it doesn't even look as good. You know, I that's another situation where I realized that sometimes more detail isn't better. You know, when I used to do my drag queen illustrations, you know, they would be digital illustrations with a million different layers of shading and highlights and colors and stuff. And oftentimes, the most important thing I would do that would give me the breakthrough aha moment that this piece is done is erasing some layers, like literally just hiding some of the layers of shading and making them invisible or making them much less opaque, and just like taking out a lot of that detail and complexity. So I took a lot of those lessons into Cardboard King, that just flat, bold colors are often the way to go, at least in the way that my brain's in that. My eye.
Does that translate to, I think one of the another kind of amazing aspects about the book is you have these characters that are, you know, creating this world, obviously Cardboard Kingdom, and the majority of the things that exist in it are these things that they have created. Is it important then, as you, as the artist, have them be things that are, I think, reasonably achievable by kids? And I know you guys have put out the templates, which is I showed my kids that today. That's their summer goal, is to make as many of those as they can. But is that something for you when you're kind of doing the character designs, that they are realistic and achievable to anyone that might want to pick up the book and try? But I've seen like a lot of the posts where, you know, kids made the actual kingdoms and stuff, which is pretty amazing.
I wanted the cardboard costumes and stuff and props to feel very tactile. And like you said, like something that a kid could make. And of course there are kids of varying skill and craftsmanship in the book. Most notably, there's a character, Elijah the Blob, and he creates his costume and no one can figure out what he's even supposed to be. And that's what his story is about. And that is kind of a struggle he has in book two as well. So for the most part, I wanted a lot of the cardboard stuff to feel very relatable and very, very kid friendly. But there are some cases where I have, you know, just for drama and for scale, I have some pretty epic cardboard stuff that's been created that realistically maybe kids wouldn't actually be able to create. But in some cases, at real life cardboard workshops and real life events in the last few years since Cardboard Kingdom came out, I've seen much more elaborate costumes than are in two, you know. And you mentioned the papercraft templates that we have for free downloadable from our website. And a really great papercraft designer, Costas Natanos, volunteered to make cool downloadable template designs of many of the costumes in our book. And I thought that was so cool. And what's great is that there we have a wide range of skill level that we label them because some of the designs are very simple and very fun, but some are incredibly complicated. And I've made all of them and I had a really fun time doing it, but a few of them nearly broke my brain because they involve some incredibly complicated folding and gluing and taping. So I have some of them hanging on the wall behind me. And I have the dragon's head and the dragon's head in on my wall. I wanted it to be relatable and aspirational, but also a little bit aspirational. You know, there's a kid, Peter, in book one of Cardboard Kingdom, who creates a whole cardboard city called Megalopolis. And I don't realistically expect one kid to make an entire cardboard city. But, you know, I was at a library event a few years ago in Texas. And one of the projects they were doing as a group was making a little cardboard city where everyone was contributing different buildings and stuff. And that looked extremely cool by the end of the
day. Yeah. And again, I think it's at least another level of whether even someone is able to do it or goes out and do it. I think it adds that level of relatability again. I think the more you can, and this goes with kids and adults, I think the more you can put aspects into a story that you can say, oh, like, I get that, or I understand that. Then when you kind of throw in the larger ideas, it's so much easier to sell the, you know, the emotion of the story when those things are visible. So seeing kids make these things and, like, you know, my kids, whether they could, I don't know, we'll try them, but like they think they can and they want to do it. I think another cool thing about kind of the way you visually attack the story is, for anyone maybe who hasn't read it, again, these, if you're looking at it, if it's the audio one, you can go check it out. But, you know, they're wearing, the easiest one, I think, is the robot. Like, you know, it looks like a robot. It looks like Awesome-O on South Park. Like, it is what you would make if you wanted a robot costume. But throughout the series, you slide into the world the children are inhabiting in their imagination. So you see their characters come to life. You see, like, you know, the actual realization of what these kids, you know, view themselves as, which is really not only empowering, but it's fun to see. And it adds kind of the superhero aspect to it. For you tackling that, is it a clear kind of line of when to pull in and out from that? I'm thinking of, like, I had it on the screen, scene where he's falling, like you get the image of, I'm a blank. Nate,
the prince, yeah.
Yep. So when he falls, like, obviously you see the kid, but, like, it hits hard when you see, you know, his character, you know, kind of defeated there. Is it easy stylistically and story-wise knowing when to kind of be in and out of those worlds?
It's really fun. You know, I love the fantasy sequences. And just to be clear to listeners, like, we see the kids' imagination, but they're not, you know, actually physically transforming. There's no actual magic in Cardboard Kingdom besides the magic of creativity. And, you know, I love slipping into the fantasy imagery or juxtaposing the fantasy imagery with real life imagery for humor, for poignance, for surprise. And, you know, this in the sequence you're talking about early on in book two of Cardboard Kingdom, Nate falls down a flight of stairs and injures himself. And so he's literally knocked unconscious, you know, and he wakes up in a hospital bedroom. And so I thought slipping into kind of like a hallucinatory nightmare would be kind of compelling and interesting and a little bit confusing for the reader as they're figuring out what's going on. And then he wakes up and it has some kind of, you know, I love a good dream sequence in terms of conveying what the character is thinking about and scared of and desiring. And you definitely see that in the Prince's Little Nightmare. So, you know, I as a lifelong comics fan, I love big dynamic battle scenes and, you know, dramatic tableaus. And when you're dealing with kids in cardboard costumes, they have their little battles, but they're always going to feel a little bit dinky. But then when you get a switch to the fantasy imagery of it, I get to really pull all my tools out of the toolbox and do dramatic superhero muscles and flowing capes and lightning blasts and everything I could think of. You know, one of the things I really love about Cardboard Kingdom is that it's a mishmash of all different kinds of fandoms and genres: superhero, fantasy, fairy tale, sci-fi, kaiju, you know? And I just love drawing all that stuff.
I think when we saw there's, again, I don't want to spoil anything in case, in the first one there's a bit of a antagonist. In the second one, and it's laid out in the preview pages, there's obviously the Beast, but there are real world, quote unquote, real world antagonists in the teenagers, which has led my 6-year-old to be deathly afraid of teenagers.
Oh no.
He asked me the other day if teenagers are going to, why do teenagers steal cars? And I was like, I don't think they do. I mean, maybe there are teenagers, but anyway, we've talked about it, but just the idea of kids like that kind of being the natural antagonist for them. And they are in the first volume as well. And obviously they kind of, you know, it's a story where, again, everyone has their own story. And I thought that was, again, kind of touching that, you know, there are stories to that as teenagers and coming out of that. But was that something kind of for an antagonist into having kind of the natural a predator for, you know, preteens and kids?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's so tricky because like I said before, I love big feelings and I love conflict, but I also don't like villainizing anyone or demonizing any type of person. You know, I try to be really responsible about not, you know, representation and not making anyone seem less than or not deserving of dignity and understanding and sympathy. And so that can, all of that can be very cumbersome as a storyteller, you know, trying to balance different points of view and not flattening the world in a bad way. The teenagers, you know, I remember when you're a young kid, how the older kids have a mystique and an appeal and can have a certain level of unknowable, like the cool factor, but also like they're kind of disdainful of what you're doing, you know, playing your little games in your backyard or something. And so you're right, the teenagers, Kurt and, oh my gosh, Lily, show up in book one in a minor role. And they seemed like the obvious choice as like a source of conflict and tension in book two. And I did want to ultimately show that they are both they're both sarcastic jerks for different reasons, and they do ultimately come to a mutual understanding with the kids. it's not a lengthy story. I kind of worked in a very goofy little subplot that Kurt is working through by the end of Roar of the Beast. That's very silly and light. So that's something I think about all the time and struggle with. And I'm a little sad that your kid did get us a negative impression of a teen. You know, it can be easy to forget as a storyteller what an impact your books can have, even a completely unintended thing like that.
Well, and I explained to him, you know, as a 6-year-old, I don't think you have anything to worry about with the teenagers. I said, as a 34-year-old, I am deathly afraid of teenagers. They scare me, they're unpredictable. And I was a teenager, which makes me even more afraid of teenagers just in general. If I see them walking across the street, it's like, what are those kids? I'm the old man now. Mm-hmm. Like, what are those kids? What's up to? I don't trust them. But yeah, he's okay with it now. I have two quick things before, because like I said, I won't want to keep it too long. One I was interested in, because again, I'm really interested in kind of the publishing aspect of kind of the young adult market. It's totally different again, in the way people are doing, you know, comics, either if it's, you know, your floppies, your singles, even versus kind of like indie publishing. In the back matter of Roar of the Beast, there are kind of your cover images and your sketches, mm-hmm. which are really great. And it's darker, like not darker in tone, but like color wise, it's a darker thing. From what we get with the other cover, was that something for you? Was that a change, or was that a note? Like how much goes into when you're working on something with a publisher in these settings? Like more than maybe if you were doing something on a single issue scale.
Mm. Yeah, lots and lots and lots of work goes into a cover for, you know, a book published by a mainstream publisher, and all of my approaches with my previous books have basically been me sending a bunch of different color sketches to the publisher, to my editor. The editor shares it with sales and the her boss and the art director, and lots of people, chime in with lots of expertise who've been doing this a lot longer than I have about all kinds of things. Like we like this better than this. We want, this color works better, or like all kinds of considerations that would never occur to me. And so for Roar of the Beast, we settled on kind of like a bright fall day aesthetic. But with a lot of my early sketches, I was kind of focusing more on the almost like a more of a Scooby-Doo vibe of like nighttime flashlights, what's lurking in the shadows. That just seemed like an obvious place to go. And I truly cannot remember if they said something specifically about like a nighttime setting, or if it was just like, oh, we really like how bright and happy the fall setting is.
So was that the cover, was that one of the sketches
mm-hmm.
in addition? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
Cause yeah, I love this.
Thank you. Yeah.
They're all great, obviously.
But. Covers are tricky, especially because pretty much all three of my books have like ensemble casts on the cover. And so just figuring out everyone's pose, how they're all going to fit on the front cover, is just a logistical challenge, I'm always trying to make sure that all the covers look good next to each other, like distinct but still unified. So as I do more and more books, that'll just get more and more complicated, because it's like, oh, I've already done a bright blue cover, I've already done a weird blue green cover. Oh man, how am I going to keep this fresh? So these are the things that keep me open.
You have to get to another season. So yeah, to see. So my last question, and it's more, I told you, and I hate to do it, I have a question from my kid, but it relates to actually what a question I did have. So I'll play his first and then I'll adjust it for normal people. Hopefully this works.
Can you make that fast?
So, I don't know if you heard that, but he wanted to know if he made the book fast. We've something we talk about. I try again. That was one of the ideas of the show originally, was, kind of going into the amount of work and effort that goes into making comics, and you know, no one sets out to make a bad book, even if that's the case. And then I talked to them about, like, we go through about like how comics are made, and you know, Captain Underpants, that's the same guy that made Cat Kong and all that stuff, like we do. But especially for something like the young adult and the markets you're working in, like it's Random House Graphic on this one. How long of a process was that to make it? Like, how long was the book made, and then how long was you kind of sitting on it before it came?
Cardboard Kingdom was my first like full finished graphic novel that actually got published, and that took us about 2 years to make, you know, with all the writing, planning, phone calls, and art. But since then, each book has taken about a year, partly because I figured out ways to like sandwich them where, like while I'm doing the final art for Doodleville 2, I'm writing the next book in the other series, you know? So it takes a long time, you know, but I do kind of a weird thing. I think a lot of my peers, like they do all their layouts, then they do all their pencils of the whole book, then they do all their inks, then they do all their colors, or they send it off to get colored. And I do not do that. I do a rough draft of the whole book, a readable rough draft. And then I do the final art, inked, lettered, colored, page one, page two, page three. And so that might be part of why the style of the book changes so much from page one to page 280. But I just find it so much more satisfying at the end of every day to have like, yes, I finished pages 27 and 28 today. Awesome. At least they're done. File them away, move on. It gives me a better sense of accomplishment. Whereas just sort of like doing your fifth pass, like in the coloring phase, you've already gone through this book a million times at every different step, and you're just like so sick of looking at it, and just coloring all day sucks. So that's just a slightly weird way I approach my.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. Like you said, kind of get the gratification that it's done, but then also like, and moving on to a very, again, I mean, in comics, every page is a story. So like to do that versus, again, kind of toiling over a larger thing with very small things like coloring or lettering and stuff like that makes a lot more sense. So, the question to wrap it up, if anyone for some reason hasn't checked out Cardboard Kingdom, or again, Roar of the Beast, the second one is out, feel like you could read either, but successfully together, it works. Like, what do you hope either kids or specifically, again, like, obviously, this is a comic book podcast, so that I would imagine there's a lot more adults listening. What do you hope they would take away from kind of the story of Cardboard Kingdom?
You know, with so many different kids in the books, I really hope that kids or adult readers really see themselves in the books, whether that's, you know, being of like a marginalized identity, whether that's, you know, I was talking to someone this morning who said that he came from a split household, and the gargoyle story about his parents' divorce like really hit him hard, and he didn't expect that kind of thing. So at one of my first school visits, they talked about mirrors and windows in terms of seeing yourself, but then also seeing into the lives of others in books. And I thought that that was so perfect and such a great way of summing that approach up, that I hope that my books offer both mirrors and windows to any of their readers.
Definitely. Yeah. And I will say I enjoy it not only as a quote unquote dad, just sitting down and reading them. I've read them multiple times to kind of prep. There's something new every time. And then on a larger, I guess, scale, I have a sibling who recently came out as transgender, and it's this kind of, you know, large topic. You know, your uncle Brant is now, I guess, Aunt Kazi, and like as a 6 and 7 year old, that's really kind of like, how do we approach that? And then we had Jack, and we had, you know, it's not necessarily one to one, but that idea of, you know, your does not feel like this is the way he feels, but this is, you know, how you appear, and like that kind of helped us to have that conversation with them. So, you know, as just something that exists in the world, like, it's an amazing resource. And again, I can't thank you enough for not only making it, but just it being really amazing as well.
Well, I really appreciate that.
If anyone wanted to find out more just about your work or just you in general, what's the best way they could do that?
I have a basic, easy peasy website, chadsellcomics.com. And on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram, I'm chadsell01. But to be honest, I don't post that much. But yeah, I should be pretty easy to find.
And the YouTube is great. If you want, if you do have for some reason kids, and my kids loved to practice drawing. I think Mo Williams did over the summer a school. It was great. So those resources are anyone who makes them are lifesavers. And we're on pages_panels, all that shit. I don't know. So again, you don't stumble upon podcasts. I'm sure you found a lot of stuff. The most important thing is to go out and pick up Cardboard Kingdom and Cardboard Kingdom Roar of the Beast, both out. Again, fantastic. Even if for some reason this story, you know, if you're a 35-year-old white guy sitting in your room complaining about Batman, whatever, the art in this is just fantastic alone. Like, it's such a beautiful book. I can't say enough good things about it. So again, I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about it.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was really great.
And that will be this episode, and you'll join us next week.